Welcome back to another episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America: The First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are deep into minute 50 already as we continue the stage show, the USO show. This title of this particular episode is A Bullet in the Barrel of Your Best Guy's Gun. There's a tongue twister for you. This minute starts with Steve Rogers marching on a treadmill in a Hollywood studio. Film background of a battlefield flickering behind him. The extras are dressed as soldiers, and the director yells, cut. Then we go back to the USO shows where the chorus girls are singing away. Steve, in his star-spangled suit, grips his shield and faces the crowd and says that line, "Each one you buy is a bullet in the barrel of your best guy's gun." The singing continues, more montages. Senator Brandt is nodding and very happy about the responses of the crowd, when suddenly an actor dressed as Adolf Hitler creeps up behind the chorus line with an exaggerated sneer aimed at Steve. Kids in the audience shout, "Turn around, he's right behind you," similar to a Panto show. So Steve continues, and he says, "Don't forget to keep our boys armed and ready." He turns around, swings a haymaker, and Hitler elapses dramatically with a cymbal crashing in sync. And unfortunately for Hitler, he's going to get hit again in Buffalo, Milwaukee, and Philadelphia, every punch landing with a cymbal. And Hal, I think we've got somebody that can talk directly to getting punched in the face by Captain America.
We do. We sort of keep thinking about how do you introduce this man? And we'll just start with welcoming a very special guest coming to us from across the pond. We've got a wonderful variety of time zones going here. But he's the actor who played the actor playing Hitler, and that is James Payton. James, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking some time to join us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me, gentlemen. Much appreciated.
I must ask, I know that this is not the only time you've played Hitler on the big screen. You also were Hitler in Monuments Men. Did you worry about being typecast?
Yeah, so they tell me. No. I mean, the reality for me in terms of Cap was that I auditioned for something else, a different part in that picture, and I got it, and that was great. And I went through a costume fitting and a sort of a shave and a 1940s haircut, and I went to see Joe, and I'd worked on The Wolfman, which was Joe's previous film, sort of standing in and doing off lines for Anthony Hopkins. So they called me back to do Cap, and Joe had always been very sort of kind and to me. Anyway, they asked me to audition. I auditioned and I got it. Did the whole dressing up thing. I go on set. I know all of the crew, and they all laugh at me and say, "James, you look like Adolf Hitler." I've never been more flattered. And then 2 weeks later, the first assistant director came up to me and said, "James, how would you feel about playing Adolf Hitler?" Well, that doesn't happen often. So you sort of grab an opportunity. So then it sort of fell to me. I knew the gag of what we wanted to do. But then it fell to me to sort of come up with something that was sort of pricking the pomposity of Adolf Hitler. So I went to that old chestnut YouTube and watched some speeches that Hitler had made, deleted my search history, obviously.
Just going to say, what sort of a list are you on?
Yeah. I thought, well, okay, well, I can, he was obviously, that moustache and the hair. I can parody that by making it sort of, as you said, pantomime and bigger and making him look, taking what he did and what his face did and making it into this sort of pantomime villain, all the while being an English actor, playing an American GI, playing Adolf Hitler on stage. So yeah, it's confusing. And the moustache was real, so.
I had a related question. I've always wanted to ask this of actors who play Hitler. This may be my only chance. So understanding that, you're a professional actor and you weren't playing Hitler, you were playing an actor who was playing Hitler. Is there still a moment when you put on the costume and you put on the makeup and you look in the mirror and you're kind of horrified to see Hitler looking back at you? Or is that just the job?
I mean, I don't know whether I'd say horrified. It's sort of somewhat disconcerting. But the truth is everybody's done it. If you've ever had a moustache and for whatever reason you've decided to take it off, hell no.
We've all stopped at the Hitler.
Everybody knows. You stop at what point just to go, oh God, everybody looks like Hitler or Chaplin. it's because it's a parody, but you know, you get in that sort of Hugo Boss suit and you pull on these on the boots, and the boots you have to have assistance with because it's impossible to both get them on and off. Mark Holmes was my dresser on Cap, and he had to come into my trailer and help me off with the boots. But it does make you feel tempted to invade somewhere. Although I'll happily admit that I didn't.
That's good.
Just because it seemed like an awful lot of effort. But yeah, it's odd because the moustache was real. You know, they added a bit of extra hair. But yeah, the moustache was real, and it's fine. You know, when you're working, when you're on set, it's absolutely fine. When you're going to a store or just sort of walking around in your everyday life, it's not okay. Because yeah. you get one of three reactions. You get people laughing, people looking at you as if you're insane, and people drawing their children closer. all understandable reactions. So, you know, if anybody approached me and said, "What the are you doing?"
Did you ever have anybody who said, "Right on, man"? Like, you're one of us.
Fortunately not, because I didn't have the outfit on all the time. But here it is. No,
you didn't so keep that.
What a souvenir! Yeah, it'll be tricky being at the craft service table with the armband and everything. I would think.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. You know, obviously, so much time has passed, but it's something that everybody is, you know, familiar with. So yeah, I used to tell, you know, people when people would sort of ask me, "What the fuck are you doing?" I would say, "Oh, I'm doing a Chaplin."
There you go.
Just get a little derby.
No, I don't think anybody bought it.
That's a start.
But I at least tried, yeah.
Was there any confusion when you brought, like, I don't know, your family and friends to the movie theater and everybody started clapping when Hitler showed up on the screen? I was just wondering what the...
Well, I went to the cast and crew screening, which we had in Leicester Square in London, I think. And I knew that it was coming. I knew it was a sort of a big moment in the movie, and I was excited to see it because I went to the wrap party, and the head of Marvel security had this DVD, and they were going to play some sort of super secret clips for the cast and crew of the movie, and for whatever reason I missed it. And he had to obviously then snap up the thing, so it was the first time I'd seen it was at the cast and crew screening. And when I came on, obviously I knew everybody in the cast and crew, so they all started cheering because they were delighted that I'd managed to book a job. Yeah, it was. I'm glad people laughed rather than took it seriously. I think even all the supporting artists and all of the other actors in the scene thought it was quite amusing because it's not something you think that is going to be in a comic book movie, particularly, you know, because that was what, back in 2010 we shot that. And it was, you know, Iron Man had been out and had been hugely successful. Iron Man 2 was sort of getting up and running. But none of us knew if Cap would, you know, translate to a sort of an international audience. So, yeah, it was a different... I mean, Marvel now is obviously a very different beast from what it was then.
How long a shoot was it for you?
That's a great question. I think I did a week. I think I did a week as Hitler, something like that. I mean, you know, there was another scene that I was talking to one of the writers, and he said to me, "Hey, James, you know, we've written an extra scene for you. So the gag is that, you know, they're looking for Steve, and they go backstage at a USO show, and you're kind of half dressed as Adolf, and he says, 'Hey, you know, where's Steve?' And you go, 'I don't know.'" We never shot it, unfortunately. But they did write. They did write it. Chris told me they did write it. But yeah, unfortunately, never. My plan, you know, because Marvel keep doing sort of spin-offs of everything, don't they? This is my theory, right? So the actor, because we never see this guy again. The actor that played Hitler had a career, you know. So the war finishes, and you know, Steve's in ice, and that's all good for him. So then this actor goes off and makes movies and TV shows. But of course, because he does that, and because he has been involved in that world, he's actually an undercover spy. But Marvel are not taking my calls anymore, so I don't know.
That'd be wonderful.
I'd go and see that.
One more question about the filming I had was, as Jim alluded to in his summary, Hitler gets punched out in Buffalo, Milwaukee, Philadelphia. You took a lot of falls. Are you a trained stuntman? Were you wearing padding? How many times do you have to flop down on stage?
Oh, an awful lot. I mean, it all suggests that we were all in all these different places across the States. The reality was, it's a theater in London, with slightly different set dressing. But I think I did, for some of it, I did wear pads. I think maybe a back pad, as I remember. But every time Chris knocked me down, he, in fairness to him, helped me back up again. But I went, when they asked me to go to dance rehearsals, you know, before we shot. Now, I'm no dancer. That's for sure. Yeah, then they're all sort of 5, 6, 7, 8. Now, I've got no idea what this is. And you know, in the end, when we shot the thing, I'm just sort of creeping on like a cartoon. But I do remember the first time we sort of shot that moment. We're on a crane, you know, and then they're sort of following me as I sort of creep down the line of dancing girls. And I sort of remember thinking, God, this is insane. I am. A guy from Cheltenham who knew nobody in the film industry, but knew that he wanted to be an actor in movies and TV shows and sort of screen work. How on earth am I here? On, you know, on one of the biggest movies shooting in the UK at the time, playing, I don't think it's fair to call him an iconic character, but perhaps the cover of, you know, the number one Captain America comic, which is there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It was released before the US entered the war. So it's a huge sort of iconic moment. I'm delighted that they left it in, because I think it was really sort of sweet. And it's a different movie from most other Marvel movies that have been made since. But yeah, bonkers. Yeah, it's the Hackney Empire Theatre in East London. Wow. Where we shot the entire sequence.
You were directed by Joe for that scene, right? Or was it the first assistant director that handled those scenes?
Joe directed all of that, yeah. I think they came out and said that it was their favorite bit in the movie, that whole sequence, because it's so beautifully done. But yeah, Joe, I sort of turned up going, I have something in mind that I want to try, and I did it in the rehearsal, and nobody told me not to. So I just carried on doing it, and they seemed to go with it.
That sounds very much like Joe. I mean, we've talked with other actors, Billy Campbell in The Rocketeer and things. He said that you only heard from Joe if he didn't like it. If he did like it, he just keep going with what you're doing. So,
yeah, it's sort of the idea of an actor's note. Now, actors get notes. You know, you do a performance and the director said, you know, it's more serious or quicker, slower, you know, whatever it's going to be, whatever note would be. So when you get no note from a director, that's a good note, because that means you're on the right track. However, the actor's brain goes, oh my God, they hate me so much. They can't even begin to think of redirecting me. So that's this sort of danger of actors getting in their heads a little bit too much. But he sort of gets to the point of going, well, I'm doing something and nobody's telling me not to, so I'll just keep running with it. But yeah, he was great. You know, Joe was great. He's a lovely, lovely, warm man who I think has done some great pictures and doesn't get spoken about enough, I think.
Hear, hear.
But yeah, he's a good man.
Hey, something I was wondering about, James, is that you know, you've got these layers to your part, and that you're an actor playing an actor, you know, playing this exaggerated sort of pantomime villain character. And the the choreography of the punches is supposed to look, it's supposed to look fake. It's not supposed to look like a good, well choreographed fight. It's supposed to be sort of clear. There's a bit of cheesiness to it that, you know, he's obviously not. Was there anything different compared to other roles you've played? If you've had other fight scenes and things, anything different that goes into making it look like actors pretending to fight rather than trying to look like a real fight?
I think it's like with most things, Hal, it's about sort of the timing. So I know that I've got to break through that line of girls at a certain point. So Chris will then turn around without looking and just swing it. So it's, you know, it's that choreography of fighting is the same as dancing, that it's all a dance, that everything has to be in the right place. So it's the same if you're sort of doing it, if you're doing a serious sort of action bit. It's still the dance with whoever else is in the scene, with the camera operator, with the boom guy. So that it's all sort of choreographed within our parameters of what we're going to do performance-wise. So it's the same. But of course, you know, there's a huge gap. You know, right. Chris Bunch is there and I'm here. So it was always going to be a comedy moment where it's obviously he's not connecting. But I still like to think to this day that I sold the punches.
Absolutely.
Very much so.
You held your own against Captain America.
Yeah, you sort of give it a little click at the neck and you're sort of selling that moment. But yeah, it was good fun. It's still one of my favorite jobs to do.
This seems to have been, I've seen the documentary about you with the appropriately named Who is James Brayton, which I can strongly recommend if people who are listening haven't seen this. Check out on YouTube, it's right there. Beautiful, beautiful show that talks about your life. Very, very intriguing moments of how your life has really changed after this movie and plus your appearance in Harry Potter. I think you became more of a presence that people would come up to you. Could you tell us a little about how for lack of a better term, the Comic-Con experience has changed your trajectory in life?
Yeah, I mean, I started doing Comic-Cons in 2009. I think that was my first one. And it was in Birmingham, and Mickey Rooney was there, and Key from the Goonies, and you know, Joan Collins, and all these sort of the great and the good, many of whom are no longer with us. And I was there, and you know, and people wanted to meet me and get my autograph and photos and stuff. And I always thought it was a little bit bonkers, because the reality is that I'm just a jobbing actor who got lucky a couple of times. You know, am I the greatest actor in the world? Yes. No.
Absolutely.
No, but I'm perfectly, I don't know what that means, but I'm perfectly capable, you know, of turning up and delivering a line, sometimes in the using the words in the right order, sometimes. But yeah, it was sort of bonkers to do it. And then, you know, sort of you get opportunities to do more. And you rock up to these places, and sometimes, you know, you're busy all day, and sometimes just people walk past your table, they look at you, they look at the pictures on your table, and then they just sort of shake their heads and walk on. It's you know, there are a lot of people who love, you know, the shows that or movies or whatever that I've been involved in, and want to meet people who were involved in those things, and that's wonderful. But I think it's very easy to be cynical about people's adoration and love for certain things that you might be involved in. But actually, when you, it would be easy to sort of go, look at these nerds, look at them all dressed up and whatnot. But the reality is they're all lovely people who really like something that you were involved in. And it's, what kind of person would I be if I didn't turn up and go, well, that's really nice. What a lovely thing. You know, the level of fame, such as it is, that I've ever had has always been really positive. But the reality is that if people recognize me, it's because they either think I'm somebody else or they go, they're not sure why. They sort of look at you and you go, is that that guy from that thing? I'm getting to be that guy from that thing more and more. But I still do Comic Cons. I still love doing them. I mean, it's great fun. You get to sort of travel the world and muck about, and people buy you drinks, which is nice. And, you know, you get to play around. So, you know, I've done them, and, you know, people dressed as Captain America, I invite them to punch me in the face if they'd so choose. It's, you know, it's, It's a lark, isn't it? It's folly, and I'm so fortunate to be in a position where I can do that. I mean, don't get me wrong, you know, the money that I've made off PAP isn't exactly going to pay for my retirement, but it's never about the money. It's about having a success. To me, in my career, is quite simply making enough money so I don't have to do anything else. I don't have to go and dig ditches, or whether people want me to dig ditches or not. But yeah, just making enough, just to make, you know, like all of us, making a little bit more than you need. I don't need $100 million or pounds. There's nothing I can buy with 200 million that I can't buy with 100 million. but to me, it's then it becomes about sort of collecting more money. All I need is enough to cover, you know, my responsibilities. Mm-hmm. You know, the apartment in which I live, you know, my children, and you know, making sure that we can live a life without having to sort of collect pennies. But yeah, but the unfortunate reality of what people think you get paid for certain things is very different from the actual reality. I remember my girlfriend at the time, she was working, and somebody she worked with said, "Hey, have you seen Captain America yet?" And she said, yeah, I've seen it. He said, you know, my favorite bit is when Hitler comes out and that whole sequence. And she said, I know him. He said, you know James Tatum? Which is weird when people know your name. Very strange. She said, yeah, he's my boyfriend. And the guy said, oh my God, he must have been paid £1 million for that. I mean, she said, do you think I'd be doing this job if he'd been paid £1 million? Fair. Yeah, it's nothing. I mean, it's very good. I'm never going to complain about being paid the money you get for the time you're working. But it's a continue. If you're relying on one thing, it might be fine for the Chris or, you know, the guys who are getting the good back ends, but for sort of co-stars like me, I make a living, and that's enough. What I ever wanted to do.
I love and respect your attitude toward Comic-Cons. I'm a cartoonist. I've been to a lot of Comic-Cons, and and, you know, there was a while in San Diego where you couldn't go to San Diego Comic-Con without running into Peter Mayhew, you know, Chewbacca sitting at his table. He was just at all of them. Lou Ferrigno was at all of them. From my perspective, as both a comics professional and a fan, it made me so happy to walk along a row of tables and see someone whose work I'd appreciated. I've talked to, you know, people like Robert Culp and Lee Merriweather, just stop to talk to them at their table and just have a 3-minute conversation to let them know, thank you for your work. It made a difference in my life. I really appreciated it. And I don't know if it meant anything to them, but it meant a lot to me to be able to express that to them. And if they didn't want to hear it, they shouldn't have shown up. So,
that's fair. That's fair. I think you sort of, all I try to do at Comic-Con is give back the same energy that I get. That's it. So if people are excited, then I'll be excited. If people are not excited, then I find that amusing, because I'm fully aware of, you know, my place in this world.
So I think it's wonderful.
That's the way to approach life, isn't it? You try and, you know, sort of throw back the energy that you get. And if it's negative energy, if you throw positive energy at that, then that really pisses people off, which is amusing.
There's a beautiful scene in your documentary where you're talking with a bunch of school children and talking about getting rid of memories from their heads with a wand. And they are all enthralled by, you are a professional storyteller. So they're just completely absorbed in what you're telling them. And you're their connection to the book they've been reading and the movie that they've seen. So being able to have that physical presence that, you know, you've affected a lot of their lives, and that they're thinking, well, maybe I can do that. Maybe I can be somebody that can provide that kind of happiness to other people.
Well, thank you. I completely lost control of that situation by the end. To me, as I said, you know, sort of growing up and, you know, when my father died and watching a movie and sort of that afternoon and going, how am I being amused and laughing in the middle of, you know, in the middle of this grief? That's what I want to do. Even though I'd sort of done stuff at school and I knew that was something I was interested in. And having known nobody, having no clue how people become movie actors or TV actors or actors in general, you sort of have to find your way. And I, And everybody's journey is going to be different. There's no sort of one way to get where you want to be. I guess it's not about giving back as such. I'm no saint. I've done things in my life that I'm not proud of. You know, the Poland thing.
Everybody brings that up. September 1939. Okay, we get it, right?
One time. What? Too soon? Come on. But I just think life is sort of fundamentally very simple for everyone. You know, we all need water, food, shelter, and ideally love. And everything after that is sort of gravy. So if I attempt to sort of put positivity into the world by just speaking to people like they're human beings, I'm not special. It's just more people know who I am than I know. By that reckoning, your postman is famous.
That's brilliant.
You know, it doesn't. When I do a Comic Con and you spend all day signing autographs, or if I've done a Harry Potter show in Germany and I'm sort of introducing the music and I'm hosting this show and you meet people afterwards and you sign your name and you take photos and you're sort of on for that moment, that's great. And when you get back to the hotel or back home and you close the door, that doesn't cease to be a thing. You know, you're just at home with me with my girlfriend or however it may be. That's real life. This is lovely, but it doesn't reflect on me as a person on a sort of day-to-day life. I still have to go to the shops and all that kind of stuff. I all we can do is try. The whole point of life, certainly for me, and I don't have any religion or any sort of belief like that. So the whole point of life, as I see it, is to leave this place ever so slightly better than it was than when we arrived. And we can only really do that through the medium of love, you know, the love of our friends and our families. And if we're so fortunate, the love of our lovers and, you know, hopefully the love of ourselves, but also being aware that kindness encompasses both hearing and saying the word no. To me, I mean, you know, because kindness isn't about saying yes to everything, you know, because that can be harmful and dangerous. So sometimes the kindest thing is to tell people no, and that's a complete sentence in and of itself. But you know, it's a divisive world at the moment, so it's tricky. But I think probably all the noise that we hear from social media and stuff online and everything doesn't really, or shouldn't really, carry over into the real world. Although, you know, as we've seen, sometimes these things do, unfortunately. What was the question?
I don't know. The answer was so wise, this. Though.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I do have a question for Hal. Hal, who do you think has a bigger Sharpie budget, James or Brian?
I don't think I'm going to wade into that one. I will say, James, just very quickly, I mean this in the best possible way. I think you have unequivocally proven on this show that you are a far better person than Hitler. And I have no qualms about going out on a limb and saying that. I'm even willing to speak for my co-host.
Thanks, Hal. That's a particularly low bar. Thank you.
Well, we have a lot of low bars on this show. And, and congratulations for not tripping over that one. I do wonder where do we see you next?
You can see me right now on season two of Wednesday on Netflix.
It's on my list of questions. You mind? Because my wife and I are watching it now and just coincidentally happened to see your episode just a week or two ago. And I don't want to spoil anything, but you play a PI who has an unfortunate encounter with some fowls, some crows. Yes. And so I just have a very fanish question and then a slightly more interesting question, I hope. The fan question is, were any of those crows real? And the second question was, were you channeling Tippi Hedren during that scene?
I mean, I was thinking about it. The crows were not real. So we had some dummy crows that were sort of thrown. But here's the kicker. There's a crow on a fishing rod, on a line, that Tim Burton is operating. So as I'm sort of running across the road to try and get back into my van, because all the murder of crows is quite literally trying to murder me, what you don't see is Tim Burton launching this fake crow at my head.
I think that's exactly how Hitchcock did it.
I wouldn't be surprised. But it's, you know, and when, you know, when I'm in the van and they're throwing them at the window and I'm sort of reacting to that. It was, it's another one of those moments. How on earth have I found myself here? Tim Burton Tim Burton, the man who's an icon, is now, you know, we've met and we've had a conversation and he was very nice and lovely and smart and what a fabulous human being and a fabulous director, is now throwing crows at my head.
Johnny Depp couldn't make that claim. So,
as I play yet another American who's not going to make it to the end of the movie. it was great. I didn't watch The Birds in advance of, but I'd seen it before, and also the makeup and prosthetic team did such a fabulous job on this headpiece thing that it sort of did the work for me. It was such fun. I auditioned for three parts in season two. The first one was a character in the asylum. It was one of the guards at the asylum. And the second one was the Kansas City scalper, which Haley Joel Osment played. And the other one was obviously the Carl Bradbury. Now, I don't know whether or not they just wanted to see what I would do in the... I assume they already had Haley Joel Osment in mind. So I assume they just wanted to gather some information and see if I could do the thing. But then, you know, the part that I wanted was the part that I got. I was thoroughly delighted. I think either later this year or next year, I did a show for Amazon. I did a couple of episodes of a new show for Amazon that I can't mention the name of, unfortunately, but let's just say the game's afoot.
Oh, boy.
Ooh. Excellent.
I do have a question. I wrote down earlier that you said that you had you tried out for a role in Captain America that wound up turning into Hitler, but what was the original role that you had tried out for?
So that was during when Cap's in the machine and he's had all the vita rays done. It was one of the scientists who says vital signs normal after something like that. Oh. I think one of the producers played it.
Oh, okay.
As I remember.
Oh, well, yeah. We're going to have to quiz Joe about that one. Find out who did he bump? Very cool. Very nice.
Yeah, it was great.
Awesome. Well, I can't thank you enough, James, for being a part of our show. We get to talk to so many different people in the production of these different films, and it's always great hearing how invested everybody is in this film. No matter who we talk to, everybody, it sounds like everybody gave 110% on what they were doing. Yeah. And I really appreciate being able to watch a small piece of your life in your documentary. And again, I can't recommend enough people see your documentary because it's just a great slice of life. But again, thank you so much. I'd also like to thank our audience for joining us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe, leave a like at our podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check back on our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. Be sure to join us next time right here on the Captain America Minute.
Do this all day.